lot of places.
Okay, I'm sorry. I have to apologize. I just started my recording, so would you just say that exactly what you said over again?
Sure. I co-produce a radio program called Taking Aim with my wife, Maya Schoen, which has been broadcasting now for 8 years. The program is heard nationally and in 77 countries. We broadcast on the Pacifica Network and also on the Progressive Network, which is an internet network, and it's picked up by many stations.
So prior to broadcasting, doing a, how long is it, prior to doing a radio program, what sort of activities were you involved in?
Well, my political life is a long one. I've been involved in struggles in many places in the world. I spent 10 years in Great Britain as a youngster, where I was working with Bertrand Russell for that period of time. I went initially to do graduate work in Great Britain and was involved in the work of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. I was then in its youth executive and worked with Bertrand Russell towards the formation of what was then the Committee of 100, which was organizing mass civil disobedience against nuclear bases and nuclear weapons and what we described as the imminent prospect of a nuclear annihilation of the planet. Later, we were involved in forming the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation, which was involved in one-on-one negotiations with heads of state with respect to various issues to do with imperialist designs on many parts of the planet. And we were also involved in the defense of political prisoners in over 40 countries, work that actually evolved into Amnesty International, with whom we had Bernard Berenson, and we were working with the people who Peter Berenson, excuse me, who gave rise to Amnesty in those early years. So it's been activity of that nature. I was imprisoned in many countries, spent 7 months in Bolivia at the time of Che's uprising, and was imprisoned there by the military after that, and eventually expelled to Peru and then to Panama and back to the U.S.
Well, thank you. So I have to get this in. So this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM in Santa Cruz. We're speaking tonight with Ralph Schoenman, who has had a long and varied career in peace work. And for our listeners, Ralph, who may not be familiar with Bertrand Russell, I was born in the early 50s. I know who he is, but maybe many of our younger listeners do not know who that is. Would you tell us just a little bit about Bertrand Russell?
Well, Bertrand Russell was probably the most significant philosophical figure in the 20th century, and certainly the greatest logician and mathematical logician since Aristotle. He was an ascendant figure in the world of philosophy, and in letters he wrote nearly 90 books. He was a person involved in a great number of social issues, pioneering work with respect to the challenge to capitalism and the advocacy of workers' control and socialism at the turn of the century. Bertrand Russell was as well a gadfly with respect to organized religion and particularly the repressive sexual mores of the Victorian era and the repressive attitude toward sexual freedom that was associated with organized religion and the church. He wrote many, many books, often very popular books, Why I'm Not a Christian, and Roads to Freedom, Freedom Versus Organization, his essays. He received the Nobel Prize for Literature. He did not receive it for peace, pointedly. As he said, there was a period after the Second World War when he was so appalled by Stalinism and by the predations of the Stalin bureaucracy that he became somewhat reconciled to the bourgeois democracies, as he put it at the time, but he was very uncomfortable given his assessment of imperialism, And as he said to me, I would, when he received all sorts of honors during that interregnum, it's then when Russell received the Order of Merit, when he was made a Fellow of the Royal Society, when he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And as Bertie used to say, I would look at myself in the mirror and ask, what perfidy have I performed to have earned the favor of these scoundrels? He intuited that there was something wrong here, and it was not long before he was in full harness of challenge to the Imperium and its predaceous wars. We formed a tribunal on U.S. war crimes in Indochina, the International Tribunal on U.S. War Crimes in Indochina, and that was a work that lasted for a good number of years. It was sort of the I could say, the forerunner of popular tribunals, no longer with the requiring the sanction of state authority, if you like, international commissions of inquiry that reached out to mass opinion and to mobilize working people around the realization as to what the state power in capitalist society represents.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for that, for the background. I know Russell was a towering figure of the last century. Unfortunately, I don't hear his name mentioned very often today in the popular discourse. And it may be the one book that I have of that he wrote is called Unpopular Essays.
Yes, and there's a wonderful essay in that collection, Unpopular Essays, called An Outline of Intellectual Rubbish. and he describes in that essay nuns who would never bathe unless they were wearing bathrobes. And they were asked why, and they since nobody could see them. And they said, ah, but you forget the good Lord. So Russell wrote, they conceive of the deity as a peeping Tom whose omnipotence enables him to see through bathroom walls, but who is stymied by bathrobes. That was quintessential Russell.
Yes. So, again, thank you for the background on Russell. And you had a long association with him. But what we're here tonight to talk about, particularly, is your upcoming appearance in Santa Cruz. You're going to be here on September 24th?
Yes.
And where will you be speaking?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I'm stymied here because Maureen, who is organizing this, Maya's got all the particulars as to exactly where I should be able to answer that question, and I can't. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't print out my message about that either.
I could probably, while we're talking, call it up on Google.
Okay. Well, I have a computer in front of me, so I'm going to try to do that also. So you're going to be speaking on the subject of Iran.
Yes, well, Maya and I will both be doing that. On Taking Aim, we have done a five-part series on Iran recently. I should mention, Lewis, that I'm deeply involved with the struggle in Iran and have been over a long period of time. I spent 8 months in Tehran in 1978 and 1979 and was involved with the armed uprising against the Shah. Was imprisoned by the Savak and then later by what we call the Savak, the KH, and then Khomeini's immediate adoption of the Savak as a model for his own secret police. But the signal characteristic of the uprising was the role of the organized working class in Iran, notably the oil workers of Khuzestan. Khuzestan is the southern province of Iran, where the Arab minority lives, Iran being a multicultural country, the Farsi or Persian population, Farsi-speaking population, is perhaps 50% of the population of Iran. Iran has a large number of national minorities, the Azerbaijani Turks, the Turkmeni population, the Kurds, the Baluchi, and the Arab minority of the south, and in Khuzestan, where the oil workers are concentrated in Avaz and Abadan, it was their general strike, which essentially broke the back of the regime. the mullahs and their mobilizations, which were late events, sought in every way to break the general strike, and actually sent emissaries from Khomeini to the oil workers at the time with the argument that the poor of Tehran, of South Tehran, and in the cities of Shiraz and Ghazvin and Najafabad were lacking in fuel oil and so on. Of course, the oil workers responded by saying to the mullahs, "What makes you think that the Shah's repressive army is going to give crude oil or fuel oil to the poor? They'll use it. They'll use it in their tanks to run down the poor in the streets." And they refused. It was the oil workers' general strike which broke the back of the regime.
I see. And I recently did a program here on the subject of Iran, and one of the comments that one of our speakers made was that the Shah's regime did not suppress the clerics. The mosques were able to operate during the regime of the Shah. However, he did suppress any kind of civil society that was opposed to him. And so the analysis was that when the revolution did occur, it was the mosques, you know, the religious establishment was firmly established, and so they were able to take power. What do you think about that?
I'm sorry to tell you that that's nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
The Ayatollahs and the mullahs were no less subject to the repression of the regime than were the students and the workers and the intelligentsia of the Shah. You have to keep in mind, Lewis, that the regime of the Shah was an entirely external imposition. The Shah was the son of a syphilitic corporal, the Shah preceding him, who had been essentially an adjutant in the British Imperial Army, and a brutal man who was sent by the British into the various parts of Iran to subjugate the national minorities. He waged a genocidal war on behalf of the British in Azerbaijan and in Kurdistan and amongst the Baluch, and was a deeply corrupt and despised figure. When the Shah died, the monarchy was finished. But in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, with the national sensibility that was sweeping the anti-colonial movements of the world, and notably in the Arab East and amongst the Persian population, the Farsi population of Iran, the national movement of Mohammad Mossadegh nationalized the oil. And immediately, the Central Intelligence Agency and British intelligence, MI5, MI6, prepared a putsch in Iran. I have to add that at the time, the Communist Party of Iran, Tuda, was a mass organization, but under the dictate of Stalin, as in so many arenas of the world, Tuda stood down. There wasn't a street demonstration or a mobilization, as Stalin was catering to U.S. imperialism to curry sphere of influence deals and what have you. That's a part of the history of not only Iran, but of many of the national movements for liberation from imperialism and the anti-colonial movements betrayed by the CP. And in particular, with respect to Iran, it had long-lasting implications because immediately that Mossadegh was overthrown in 1953, the Central Intelligence Agency, with the assistance of the Israeli Mossad, established the most brutal secret police with torture, the paradigm in every one of these terrible prisons across Iran. And irony, of course, is that Tuda was decimated. The immediate target was the organized working class, a great deal of repression directed towards the oil workers, the auto workers, the teachers' unions. The working class was the primary target, but not the only target of the regime. With respect to the specific question of the treatment of the mullahs, Ayatollah Khomeini was imprisoned, as were many of the leading Shia mullahs in Iran. Interestingly enough, Ayatollah Khomeini, when in the Shah's prison, immediately signed the declaration disavowing opposition to the regime. He basically capitulated. It was not an easy thing to withstand their torture, that should be made clear. But he was then allowed to go into exile in Iraq. In contrast to that, Ayatollah Taleghani, who I knew well, of Tehran, who had been associated, he was amongst those mullahs that had a left orientation, if you like. He was oriented to the mass of the population, unlike many of the mullahs, and he refused in any way to cooperate. He was tortured and imprisoned for 13 years. When he was released, he was considered a national hero. He was not a supporter of Ayatollah Khomeini, let it be made clear. But the notion that the mullahs were not subject to repression is untrue. The mobilization that was done from outside by the mullahs through the transmission of tapes, they were played in the mosques, but they were not merely played in the mosques. And the engine of opposition to the regime over the many years since the installation of the Shah arose through not merely the workers' organizations, but the students and the intelligentsia, and the armed struggle of the Fedayeen Khalq and the Fedayeen Mujahideen, which were one organization initially. They were Marxists, but the Mujahideen wing of the Fedayeen were Muslims. But it's interesting to note that in this period, Louis, there was a very outstanding figure named Ali Shariati, who was a Muslim who looked to Islam for the texts that inspired social resistance, social change, advocacy on behalf of the disadvantaged and the poor. And he had a profound influence on young Muslims and on the student generation, Ali Shariati. He was assassinated. When I was in Iran, I spent time with his father and the family in Masad in the north of Iran. But the point here is that the Islamic youth and radicals who were fighting the repression of the regime were subject to no less persecution and subjugation than were the secular forces in the resistance. The significant thing about the Ayatollahs that were grouped around Khomeini, notably when they were in exile in Neuf-le-Château in France, is that the U.S. was very interested in them. And a number of their ranks, I think it's fair to say, Ghobzadeh and Ibrahim Yazdi, amongst others, perhaps Rafsanjani and Beheshti, were in contact with the Central Intelligence Agency in that period, because the CIA was looking for options to the Shah, who was increasingly isolated in Iran. Not that they wanted in any way to encourage a mass uprising, but they were looking to the Islamic officers in the army to form a more broadly based autocratic regime than the Shah was allowing them to maintain. So the notion that the mullahs, that somehow the mosque became the arena of protest because the mullahs escaped repression, I think is not grounded at any kind of reality in Iran.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for clarifying that. Today, the situation in Iran, we have President Ahmadinejad apparently reelected, very widely disputed results. But he remains in power. He will be in Washington next week, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes, he's made overtures to the regime in Washington to have negotiations. It's important to understand that for all the rhetoric, the mullahs have consistently sought to align themselves with U.S. imperialism. And in practical terms, they've manifested their interest in being a partner by their support for U.S. operations in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, and for that matter, in Iraq itself. Notwithstanding that, the objects of imperialism and of the Zionist regime from their inception have been to dismantle Iran. That is not particular to Iran, but Iran has long been in their sights. This goes back, it's a subject that has been one that I've addressed in Maya over a period of time, notably in our book, The Hidden History of Zionism, and in the other book, Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed. But in the chapter called A Strategy for Conquest, we disclose and discuss an important strategic article that was prepared. It was originally being scripted in 1979, but by 1982 it received formal disclosure in a publication in Israel called Kivunim, which means directions, which is the journal of the Department of Information of the World Zionist Organization. Its author was Oded Yinon, who was attached to the foreign ministry and, as it was stated at the time, reflects high-level thinking in the Israeli military and intelligence establishment. The article was called A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s. And it outlined a timetable for Israel with imperial support to undertake the dissolution of the Middle Eastern states. And it literally addressed them one by one. And Yinon was reviving the ideas of the former labor foreign minister of Israel, Abba Iban, who described the Arab East as a mosaic of ethnic divergence and advocating restoring the region to what he called a millet system of the Ottoman Empire, where administrative rule was based upon local functionaries presiding over discrete ethnic communities. So what they were talking about was breaking up each of the countries into their ethnic components. And without going into a great deal of detail, because this is a very elaborate document, let me stress here that the assault on Iran flowed very much from that design. And I should say that beyond the importance of the strategy for Israel in the 1980s, this became a paramount document as of 1979 in U.S. imperial circles. It was very much taken up by what are called the neocons, and in particular the Zionist or pro-Zionist elements within the U.S., who saw it as a model for U.S. imperialism itself, and it became very much the rationale for what later unfolded as what we call the false flag operation, the staged events of September 11th. Each country, ad-Syriatum, Iraq, Afghanistan, and then Iran, was to be dismantled. And the resources seized and essentially passed through client, but very much weakened figures, presiding over a decimated country with its social and economic and infrastructure laid low, functioning as essentially satraps of direct imperial control. That very much underlies the whole strategy of imperialism and of Israel, of course, as a stratum of U.S. imperialism towards Iran. And it, I think, explains and goes to why so many people on the left have perceive the uprising against Ahmadinejad as something of a pro-imperialist adventure, which is fatuous on its face. Not because imperialism doesn't attempt to destabilize Iran as it does every other country. Not because there isn't a putative conflict with a faction of the mullahs over this question of having a use of nuclear power for electrical energy and power in Iran. Those are essentially ploys to create a rationale for breaking up the regime, for the effective blockade of Iran and the boycott that has been imposed, the starving of Iran of capital and the blocking of it of critical equipment for the renovation of their refining capacity and all of those things. But that is not at the service of renewing the Iranian revolution. The last thing that imperialism, let alone the Zionists, have in mind is for the united working class in Iran and a mass movement that overthrew the Shah to be reclaiming its agenda, because the revolution in Iran was hijacked by the mullahs, not without a considerable clandestine support from imperialism itself at the time. And I think it's essential to understand that the current uprising that's unfolded around these elections, of course, when one speaks about elections being taken, the election is a staged undertaking in the first place. The only people who are allowed to run are those who are supporters of a theocratic state. The only candidates who are entitled to be active politically, the only figures who can be active politically, are those who are in support of a theocracy. There are no political rights for secular parties or secular figures. What kind of election is that? It's an election on the order of those they hold in the Zionist state, where to be part of the political process, you have to accept the Palestine is a an exclusively Jewish state with all rights defined in terms of ethnic origin and religious affiliation. So the illegitimacy of the election bears not so much on the question of how the results were manipulated or not manipulated. In any event, the repression and the terror that's waged against dissidents across the board in Iran militates against any possible election, because the risk to people of voting or mobilizing or acting against the regime is manifold. But the question of the results is a secondary issue in regard to the legitimacy of an election of this kind. And another essential point about the character of the opposition: the likes of Hussein Mir Mousavi or Rafsanjani, who are deeply involved with the most repressive features of the regime from its inception, they hardly speak for the mass of the population in Iran. Their opposition, as they the mullahs have divided over a number of issues, they're fighting over the spoils. The question of privatization is not one that divides Ahmadinejad and Rafsanjani or Mir Hussein Mousavi. The question isn't whether to privatize, but how. Because the faction that's associated with Khamenei and Ahmadinejad is associated with what are called the Bunyads, which are vast private mullah-based foundations which arrogate to themselves the control over property, the control over commerce, and divide it up amongst the oligarchy. Whereas Rafsanjani and Mir Hussein Mousavi have been associated with an outright privatization in the hands of speculators, and the oligarchy operating not unlike the bureaucracy under Putin wants to arrogate all this to an oligarchy of the political regime itself. Their opponents, who are long associated with them, are stating they need a broader base. They need to hand out some of the spoils and broaden the hold of the bourgeoisie in Iran. That is the locus of their conflict. But the struggle of the mass of the population has vanishingly little to do with that. And in fact, Louis, the press, the bourgeois press in the United States and in Western Europe has been loath to acknowledge that these mobilizations did not begin with the outcome of the election. These mobilizations, which have been nonstop since the mullahs assumed power, took on a particular focus on May Day, when the Iranian workers mobilized, when the bus workers and the auto workers and the teachers and the oil workers mobilized, then the regime panicked. The Codro auto workers, they waged a major struggle on May 22nd because workers are denied their unpaid wages. They're denied the right to organize. They're denied the right to be represented by independent trade unions. And on May 22nd, the auto workers of Codro in Iran waged a wide-ranging strike to receive their unpaid wages, and the regime backed down. The workers in Iran Codro were successful. They mobilized in assembly halls. They mobilized at the point of production. They demanded immediate payment of their unpaid wages. They demanded last year's production record bonuses, and the management of the Iran Codro would not pay any wages, any bonuses, or any of the back pay. And the strike not only did not die down, but it spread along production lines amongst auto workers across Iran. It was an enormous and important uprising of the working class. Where have you read about it in the Western press? It's not only the auto workers of Codro, but the auto bus workers union, Sendikai Sherkat Vahed in Farsi, who made a passionate declaration at the time with respect to the generalized popular resistance to the regime. We have witnessed the passionate presence of millions of women and men, old and young, ethnic and religious minorities in Iran, people who want their government to recognize our most basic rights. In the current situation, we experience threats, arrests, killings, naked persecution that grow in dimension. We are faced with a deep political and economic crisis. Million-strong protests have manifested themselves, but the Auto Bus Workers Union declares, in the absence of freedom for political parties, our organization has been deprived of social institutions that can protect it. The workers of the Auto Bus Workers Union consider their social involvement to be the certain right of every member of society, and that workers across Iran will continue their struggle, which has been going on for years. We demand the recognition of labor union and social rights in Iran. We declare that the international labor organizations must support the imprisoned Iranian workers and defend the institution of trade unions in Iran. We declare that this day must be viewed as a day for the demands of workers, of trade unions, of human rights in Iran. We ask fellow workers to struggle for the trampled rights of the vast majority of our people. We are organizing for the spread of a struggle for justice and freedom in the name of the Iranian workers' movement and of the trade union movement in Iran. This is a declaration that was taken up by the teachers, by the oil workers. 900,000 Iranian workers were on strike in 2005 all across Iran. They had not been paid for over a year. They marched from town to town across Iran to Tehran. They gathered in front of the Islamic Assembly along with their union leaders. They slept in parks. Mine workers from Khalazari mines of Birjand mobilized. The working class has not been passive in this event. And all that the bourgeois press wants to focus upon are the students, which is fine. But one interesting aspect of this, I'd like to ask the question, where else in the world has a student movement been deprecated as being bourgeois or middle class? Where are students not, for the most part, the sons and daughters of the professional classes, of the petty bourgeoisie, of the somewhat more advantaged, because very infrequently are there scholarships for working people to enter universities. But students in universities who struggle against the regime, such as that of the Shah, or who engage in the anti-war movement, or who join radical movements, who become radicalized as youngsters in college, who identify with the conditions of the oppressed, who fight colonialism, when are they put down because of their class origin? By that criterion, what would we say about Vladimir Lenin if the criterion is his class origins, the son of attorneys and of petty bourgeois? How about Leon Trotsky? How about Karl Marx? How about Friedrich Engels, who owned factories? The criterion is not the class origins of people, but their political lives and their identification and their advocacy. It always has been, and it ought to be. And the class character of the resistance in Iran is indisputably a mass a mass movement that is rooted firmly in the struggles of the working class.
Well, thank you. Thank you again. Your analysis is so thoroughgoing, thorough and broad. I just wanted to add a couple of other figures there. Fidel Castro and Che Guevara both were from upper class families.
Well, of course. I mean, actually, in particular, with respect to Fidel, Fidel came from a very privileged landowning family.
Yes.
In Cuba and. Interestingly enough, Fidel was a leader of a liberal Orthodox party, and it was only when the election which brought him into the Cuban parliament at the time was canceled by Batista that he radicalized and was pushed towards the conclusion that there was no way to get rid of the Batista regime except through armed struggle.
Well,
interestingly enough, with respect to Che, Che was radicalized by his relationship with Hilda Gadea, who was a young Peruvian woman who was the leader of the Aprista, which the APRA was a left bourgeois party in Peru that was opposed to the autocratic regime. Hilda was a leader of the youth movement. Che was engaged in a motorcycle adventure as a young man across Latin America. He encountered Hilda in Peru, was together with her in some of the large and mass struggles there. They wound up in Guatemala at a time, interestingly enough, when the CIA Central Intelligence Agency in the persons of E. Howard Hunt was drawing on their experience recently in Iran with the overthrow of the Shah. And they decided they could replicate this in Guatemala with respect to the regime of Jacobo Arbenz, who was an army officer of a mild reformist character who was considering land distribution in a country which was so terribly in the hands of the Latifundia, the oligarchy, and the mass of the indigenous population, Maya descendants, the Indian population of Guatemala completely frozen out. The putsch that unfolded in Guatemala had a profound radicalizing impact on the young Che Guevara. And they went from there to Mexico. And interestingly enough, Fidel at the time with some of his associates was in Mexico. And a former general in the from the Loyalist Army in Spain was teaching them about the resistance to Franco and the tactics and features of guerrilla warfare. It's there that Che met up with Fidel, and they came to the conclusion that the struggle was not a national one, but an intercontinental one, which is what motivated Che Guevara to throw in his lot with the young Cuban revolutionists and so on. And all of this by way of supporting your own point that people are drawn into social struggles by their lived experience. And youngsters who have come from relatively advantaged backgrounds, they read, they immerse themselves in the lives of people around them, and they are radicalized by the experience.
All right. I want to follow up on your thoughts about Iran that you mentioned earlier. That you, I believe, if I have this right, that you think the program of the United States and the other imperialist powers is to dismantle Iran. That was suggested in Iraq just a year ago. The U.S. regime said we're going to divide up Iraq into, you know, various ethnic,
Well, that's very
regions.
Much what they've. You see, the mantra is you'll hear it from every imperialist spokesperson that these countries are not their failed states, that Iraq is not a country, but it's a warring arena of Shia and Sunni and of Kurds and the Marsh Arabs of the South, the Turkmeni, and so on. which flies in the face of the lived experience of people, the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, which was a weakening of imperialism generally, and the death rattle of French and British and Belgian and Dutch and German colonialism, when the U.S. Had hegemony and began to usurp the former colonial domain of enemy and ally alike. And what arose in the Arab East was a passionate national struggle for self-determination against colonial subjugation. It not only in Egypt, but in Iraq and in Syria and in Iran, throughout the region, it was a national sensibility. The uprisings in Iraq were national in character. The U.S. had imposed Nuri es Said, who was known as the Stooge of Baghdad. He was essentially a British colonial satrap, a hated figure. He was resisted by the entire population of Iraq. And in the Iraqi revolution of 1958 that overthrew Nuri es Said and the infant King Faisal, it brought into power Abdul Karim Qasim. I met Abdul Karim Qasim in 1962 in Baghdad. It was a part of a series of meetings that the Russell Foundation had organized. I'd met with Nasser and with the then Prime Minister of Lebanon, Saab Salem, and with Abdul Karim Qasim in Baghdad to organize the Arab leaders around a program of a united struggle against the character of the Zionist state. And at the time that I met with Abdul Karim Qasim, it was quite clear that he had nationalized oil. The oil companies were confined to 0.1% of the territory of Iraq. And unlike every previous regime and that of his successor, he raised the question of the amputation of Kuwait by British imperialism at the end of the 19th century, where the coastal access of Mesopotamia was cut off by the British. And the Kuwaiti student movement for decades had mobilized to reunite itself with the mother country, as they called it. Abdul Karim Qasim was killed in an assassination organized by the Central Intelligence Agency, and the figure who did that work for the CIA was a young right-wing member of the Ba'ath named Saddam Hussein, who was run by the CIA station in Baghdad and succeeded on his third attempt in assassinating Abdul Karim Qasim. And immediately what was established in Iraq was what was called the Palace of the Damned, which was a horrendous torture chamber that the Central Intelligence Agency and the Mossad, again, assisted the regime in establishing. The head of it was Saddam Hussein. For 27 years, he was the instrument of U.S. imperialism in Iraq. He was the counter-revolution personified. But the interesting aspect of this is that after the Iranian Revolution, when the Shah was overthrown, when the Shah was forced into exile, you have to keep in mind that for 6 months, the head of NATO, General Heuser, established in the penthouse of the Tehran Hilton, a command base for attempting to subjugate the population and coordinate the mass repression in Iran. And when at the last moment at the attempt on the part of Khomeini and the mullahs to abort the uprising, I mean, just be specific about that, because every day the masses were mobilizing in Iran, in the streets of Iran, particularly in the capital in Tehran. Masses would mobilize and wait like a wave, move towards the armed to the army and towards the police, and they would fire, and then the wave would recede and people would disappear into the alleys of the working class quarters of South Tehran. And increasingly with the deaths, there would be funerals of the dead which brought out even larger numbers, the soldiers stopped using their weapons. And now the Savak became extremely agitated and went to the barracks of the soldiers, notably in South Tehran, a Savak officer, and demanded that the soldiers use their weapons. And one of the soldiers refused, and the Savaki officer shot him dead. And now the soldiers in the barracks rose up. They killed the Savaki officers, and they started handing out their rifles to their weapons to the masses. And once this happened in that barrack, it spread all over Iran. I was deeply involved in that, particularly in that moment at the barracks in South Tehran. And now Khomeini and the mullahs sent out their cars everywhere. The imam says everybody must return home. The imam says it is a violation of Islam, and the masses absolutely ignored this. The mullahs were desperately trying to prevent a mass uprising. What their game was to have a deal with a layer of the officer class to have what would be called a nationalist putsch, a religious officer's putsch in Iran. After the success of the overthrow of the Shah, when the mullahs then availed themselves of the files of the Savak and began to round up wherever they could the leaders of the working class, the leaders of the armed struggle, the youth, the mujahideen, the fedayeen khalq, when this process was unfolding, it was the default of what passes for the left in Iran. Not only the Tudeh party, but all of the left organizations failed to meet the challenge of mobilizing people around a banner of social ownership to challenge the mullahs programmatically. There was nothing to stop them except the limitation of their own politics, tail-ending these miserable mullahs. And as soon as this process unfolded, Brzezinski, Zbigniew Brzezinski, called a meeting in Kuwait with Asaba, the emir of Kuwait, with King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, with Saddam Hussein, and they organized that Saddam Hussein would invade Iran, notably the oil-producing province of Khuzestan, where the Arab minority lived, on the assumption that the Arab masses who had been persecuted by the Shah and again by the mullahs, because Admiral Madani under Khomeini continued the subjugation of the Arab population of Khuzestan. But the oil workers in Khuzestan, in Avaz and Abadan, were the most politicized sector of the Iranian working class. They were in the mass in the Tudeh party, however that leadership betrayed the struggle. They were in the nationalist party of Mossadegh, and they resisted. They did not respond at all to the siren call of Saddam Hussein's invading armies. They didn't look upon it as anything but the counter-revolution, and they fought, and they resisted. And now Kissinger said, bleed them both white. And as the Emirates and the U.S. continued to pour chemical and biological weapons into Iraq, the Israelis were assigned the task of assisting Khomeini and Shariat Madari, the mullah in Tabriz, with support. So that over 1 million people died in that internecine conflict, which imperialism orchestrated when they were unable successfully to amputate Khuzestan. They sought to bleed both countries white by having an ocean of blood of the young wash over both Iran and Iraq. That's the fundamental character of imperialism. And it's out of that whole design that the grand chessboard of Brzezinski is written, in which he designates Central Asia and the Arab East as the arena in which imperialism has to establish its undisputed hegemony. That's where they lay out the design of what he called the bear trap in Afghanistan, when you had in Kabul, partly as a response to the uprising in Iran and to the radicalization that had unfolded in Iraq. In Afghanistan, you had two working-class parties, Marxist parties, that vied for power. They distributed the land. They removed restrictions on women, and they were immediately targeted by imperialism in an attempt to create an internecine civil war, and that is where the so-called Al-Qaeda comes into existence, Al-Qaeda being a non-exist little faction amongst the fundamentalists that were funded by the Central Intelligence Agency, and they were not merely targeting Kabul. They sent these essentially terrorist groups with U.S. arms and U.S. Officers into the Republic, the Islamic Republics of the then Soviet Union, into Turkmenistan, into Uzbekistan, into Kazakhstan, into Kyrgyzstan, and they were seeking to destabilize those republics, and so they were taking this task on in Afghanistan itself. So the hand of imperialism in these events is constant, but the abiding enemy of imperialism and of these miserable regimes that are imposed through either acquiescence or direct intervention by imperialism, such as that of the mullahs in Iran, the abiding enemy of that is the conscious workers' movement and the mass movement that the students and the youth and the intelligentsia associate themselves with to free these countries from not just the imperial heel, but from the country-selling politicians who want only to have a cut, their piece of the action. They are always looking for their means through which they can benefit, and there is nothing so clear about that social phenomenon as the role of all of the mullahs in Iran, and notably, I mean, the what has been called the astronomical plunder of Rafsanjani, the mafia of wealth and power. There have been enormous documentations of this, a 9,500 word report on Rafsanjani's mafia of wealth and power called Excellencies of the Mafia, a deadly infected tumor that documents the extent to which Rafsanjani has arrogated to himself through colossal embezzlements, threats, intimidation, using front companies, grants that have been allowed to him in the condensed gas company, receiving billions of dollars in foreign oil contracts, handing over huge bribes to middlemen dealing with the major oil companies such as Total, Elf, Statoil, Norinco. I mean, a money laundering network smuggling antiques and commodities. Complete private control over Kish Island, which is a free trade zone, huge profits in trade, a monopoly of the air industries, having complete control over the payoffs in the country's ports and customs service, huge benefits through special privileges in import and export, smuggling through all the ports, holding a monopoly of the pistachio trade, eliminating all minor traders, massive foreign investments in building highways, luxurious tourist centers, holiday villas in Canada, oil equipment companies in Britain. It goes on. And it's not just Rafsanjani. And I have to mention here, Louis, that at a certain point in the struggle against the Shah, I was working with a group called Jambesh, which means struggle in Farsi. The most noted figure there was Ali Asghar Haji Syed Javadi, who was a very distinguished writer and intellectual in Iran that had led a very significant mobilization against the Shah. And at one point I was asked to go to Nifla Chateau, where Khomeini was still in exile, to discuss with him, and I did. I met with Khomeini and with Rafsanjani and Beheshte and Gopsadeh and Ibrahim Yazdi, and with Bani Sadr, who would eventually become a so-called reformist prime minister. And the mullahs had no interest in any remote sense accommodating a secular movement in Iran. That was clear. I flew back with Khomeini in the plane, landed in Tehran. Figure who had associated himself for a short period of time with Jambesh, who had once been imprisoned by the Shah, a former high-ranking army officer, Kavakoli is his name, Ruhollah Kavakoli, who went with us when we were out in the remote towns trying to organize the fight back against the Savak. And he would say, you know, you should put your support with the patriotic officers. We will deal with these excitable Muslims and so on. I began to record this. I kept clandestine recordings of his ravings for a long time. And when Khomeini appointed him the deputy head of the armed forces, we knew what was coming. And I played those tapes at the Tehran Hilton after he received that appointment, and it resulted in huge demonstrations. There was still the will to fight the mullahs at that point in time. And the consequence for the mass movement was that they moved immediately into a state of advanced repression. They began to round up the mujahideen. They began to round up fedayeen. The students had to go in hiding. The workers were particularly targeted. One has to keep in mind that during the uprising in Iran, the workers, after the overthrow of the Shah, set up what are called shura, or workers' councils, in factories all across Iran for workers' control. I mean, these are the very phenomena that characterized the Paris Commune and the beginnings of the Bolshevik Revolution. It was a workers' uprising that was the heart and soul of that struggle against the Shah. And it's the betrayal, because there was no equivalent of a Bolshevik party in Iran at this point. The left organizations did not rise to their historic responsibilities here. There was no attempt to coordinate programmatically, organizationally, a struggle for power. And the mullahs were allowed to usurp that revolution. And the fruit of that is this desperately brutal and corrupt and repressive theocratic apparatus in control. The detailed report on the activities of the wealth and power mafia in Iran on the part of the on the mullahs is staggering. And it's not particular to the likes of Rafsanjani or Mir Hussein Mousavi. One of the significant things to keep in mind about Mir Hussein Mousavi, the so-called reformer, is that for 8 years he was the prime minister of the Islamic Republic during the darkest days of the regime. He was also, let it be known, a part of the arms for hostage arrangement with the Reagan administration that was known as Irangate. He played the premier role in the wave of repression in the 1980s that exterminated a generation of Iranian leftists. Thousands of socialists and communists and intellectuals were jailed and tortured and killed. Rafsanjani is now refashioning himself to the delectation of imperialist newspapers as a reformer. He is a figure who is associated with the most brutal of the reprisals, notably after the Iraq-Iran war unfolded, when under the cover of resisting the invasion from Iraq, the most terrible repression was unleashed. And all factions amongst the mullahs supported the neoliberal economic policies and privatizations that have pauperized vast swathes of Iran's working population. And that's why the so-called debates between Ahmadinejad and Mousavi and Ahmadinejad and Karoubi are farcical, because these are birds of a feather. These are figures who were in lockstep in the mass repression and in the assumption, the usurpation of the control over the economic life of the country. I mentioned before what are called the Bonyari Mostazafen va Yan Bazan. These are the charitable foundations of the Islamic Republic, the second largest commercial enterprise in Iran. It was founded in 1979, interestingly enough, and took over the role of the Pahlavi Foundation of the Shah as an economic, cultural, and social institution. It controls manufacturing and industrial companies. The profits are accorded to the foundation, and it's associated with the mullahs in power. It is what they use to finance the Basiji, which they claim to be as many as 20 million. Which are basically their brown shirts. who they use to come with their iron bars into the universities or into South Tehran to terrorize the workers if the workers resist the regime. And the they renamed the Pahlavi Foundation of the Shah, Bunyad-e-Mustazafen, which means in Farsi, Foundation of the Oppressed. And they more than doubled the property of the 50 millionaires that they confiscated. And they arrogated to themselves $20 billion of factories, 140 factories, 470 agribusinesses, 100 construction firms, 64 mines, 250 commercial companies. By 1994, the Bunyads had 6 trillion rials in business transactions, and that exceeded the amount of taxes taken by the government. And this vast fund serves as basically a slush fund for the oligarchy. They control 40% of Iran's production of soft drinks, including the cola, the Zamzam cola, which they own and produce. They control the newspapers Etelat and Kehan. They control 20% of the production of textiles, two-thirds of glass products, the dominant share in tiles and chemicals and tires and foodstuffs. The value at one time was estimated at $12 billion, but it exceeds that. So the Bunyad has this basically monopoly of control over whole sectors of the economy. And all of the mullahs are party to this, but the Rafsanjani faction wants to hand it out to elements of the bourgeoisie, the way in which Rafsanjani and the Mir Hossein Mousavi themselves have helped themselves over the many years since the mullahs assumed power in Iran. So it's what the Wall Street Journal in 2007 called Iran's holy money machine, where they describe what is an intermingling of faith and money, collecting cash, land, jewelry, works of art, the Islamic Republic's biggest and richest business empire. We are an Islamic conglomerate, says Mehdi Azizian, business advisor and brother-in-law of Ayatollah Abbas Faiz Tabassi. We don't expect anyone to understand everything we do because it is so huge. Money is power, and we mullahs dominate the important parts of the Iranian economy. So let's be clear about the regime of Ahmadinejad and of his nominal opponents amongst these reformers. This is the same handful of corrupt mullahs who are terrorizing the population of Iran with their theocracy. I don't even need to, at this point, to spell out what it means for women, what it means for anybody who has the slightest desire to lead a secular life, women who are considered to have been reckless in exposing their ankles have been hanged, women who are accused of having sexual relations with somebody, whether there's evidence for that or not, as if that were a crime, have been subjected to a particular fiendish form of execution in which they are hanged from what am I looking for here? There's a particular form of industrial it's used in industrial construction, and they're hanged from it in a form that causes very. The neck isn't broken, there's slow asphyxiation. It's been described by many of the workers' organizations. It's been described by Humanité, the French Communist Party publication. It's been spoken to by the Iranian workers' movement. It's the same that has been, the same kind of fiendish repression has been not only addressed to women, but to homosexuals or anybody who is even remotely suspected of being gay. This is a retrograde theocratic regime worthy of the Middle Ages, and to resist imperialist predations upon Iran is an obligation of everybody, and to identify them and expose them for what they are. But why that translates into affording the slightest political or social support for the mullahs and their predations in Iran escapes me. It seems to me that people who are what passes for the left should be capable of walking and chewing gum at the same time.
Well, again, thank you. So labor, you're saying, and the working class is playing an essential role in this, any resistance to Ahmadinejad or the mullahs or the Shah or throughout the history. In Iraq, I know when the U.S. invaded and Paul Bremer took over and basically scrapped Iraqi civil law, one of the things that he did retain was Saddam Hussein's ban on unions in that country.
Well, very much so, of course.
Yes, so.
But one has to keep in mind, Lewis, that the measures against the Iraqi working class that Saddam Hussein adopted were done at the direction of U.S. imperialism. He was, as I mentioned, he was mm-hmm. their man in Baghdad.
Right.
There's no ambiguity about this. In our book, Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, we went into particulars about how Saddam Hussein was recruited, the head of the CIA station in Baghdad who ran him. This repressive agenda was something that was not of his own invention. He was basically their man in Baghdad.
Yeah. So let me ask you this question: to what? Yes, the U.S. is making a lot of noises about Ahmadinejad and his, you know, his nuclear program and this and that, you know, activity that they perceive to be, if not criminal, then it, well, they're calling it criminal. He's breaking all these resolutions and
what resolutions?
Well, there's been UN resolutions passed. There are sanctions imposed on Iran.
Let me ask you a question.
So,
what is the class composition of the member states of the United Nations?
Well,
it is no different than that which we have in the United States.
Right.
What are we discussing here? You have hegemony for U.S. Nuclear arsenals and the Zionist state, which has something like 100 hydrogen bomb missiles mm-hmm. and a huge arsenal that is financed and completely backed and, in essence, created by U.S. imperialism, has the audacity to raise the question of whether a dependent country in the target sites of Zionism and imperialism should actually consider the prospect of self-defense. But the irony, of course, is everybody has made it manifestly clear. The mullah regime does not aspire to have nuclear weapons. They are not able, with the acquisition of a handful of early nuclear weapons, to in any way confront or challenge or resist imperialism through that means. The engine for seeking the nuclear power stations to generate electricity flows from the strangulation of the Iranian economy and its refining capacity. It flows from the starvation of the country from having the equipment necessary to update and modernize and expand their refining capacity. It's the blockade, which is an act of war that has been visited upon every targeted regime. It's been installed against Iraq. It was installed against Yugoslavia. It's installed now against Iran. It's imperialism's attempts to bring a regime to its knees. And their quarrel with the mullahs is strictly this, that they don't want the mullahs to monopolize the means of production in Iran. They want them to be merely hired hands. They don't want any semblance of a national existence in Iran. They want a country that has been so decimated, so fragmented, with its social institutions so utterly destroyed, that there is no social cohesion remaining in the country. That's what they did and are doing with the murder of Iraq. That is what is unfolding in Iraq. That's what's unfolding in Afghanistan. That's what's unfolding in Pakistan. That's what happened in Somalia. That is the blueprint that is intended for Iran.
So there, it seems what I'm starting to think here is that you think Ahmadinejad is really beside the point, and the program is to keep Iran weak, and if Ahmadinejad helps to keep Iran weak, then then that's okay with the United States.
Look, Ahmadinejad and the mullahs on all sides have signaled repeatedly and ad nauseum to the U.S., even with respect, by the way, to the Zionist state. They talk about the by the way, Hamas has done the same. Acknowledgement of Palestinian rights in Gaza and the West Bank. What does that represent, that call? That's saying, we're down with acknowledging the legitimacy of the Zionist state of settler colonialism in 78% of historic Palestine. We're down with some little Bantustan in the remnant Gaza and West Bank. We're down with some international settlement along such lines. They're constantly signaling, give us a fig leaf of legitimacy with which to go along with you, the way everybody else has. That's the agenda of Ahmadinejad, and they demonize Ahmadinejad as a method of stoking the fires for an outright assault on Iran. Do you think anybody in the country, including people who have illusions about Mir Hussein Mousavi or Rafsanjani, favor an Israeli or U.S. All-out aerial assault on Iran? There's nobody in Iran who is welcoming this dread prospect. Everybody understands what has happened to the neighboring states. They understand what the meaning of an imperial attack will be. An unparalleled assault, which will destroy the whole infrastructure of the society. And the truth of the matter is that Ahmadinejad can stand on his head and whistle Dixie; it won't make any difference. It isn't a question. These are essentially artifices of imperial propaganda. The nominal militancy of Ahmadinejad. What does his so-called militancy consist? His supposed populism with respect to the poor of South Tehran. You know what that amounts to? On election day, they offer them a few dollars. I mean, it's more like bribing votes.
Mm-hmm.
People aren't taken in by that. How can they be? They're unemployed. Their standard of living is falling drastically. They're not allowed to have trade unions. They can't open their mouths if their salaries are not paid. You think working people are dumb? They haven't lived through this generation after generation. They don't recognize what's happening to them. There's vanishingly little. Why? Actually, the truth of the matter is that the Basiji, with their iron rods, were not only out at the universities busting heads, they were out in South Tehran. The mobilization and support of Ahmadinejad has been generously claimed to have had 10,000 people present. 3 million people mobilized against the regime. Where are the workers of South Tehran who support Ahmadinejad as claimed here? They're largely in hiding. Not the supporters of Ahmadinejad, but the workers of South Tehran. I mean, read the statements that come out of the actual workers' organizations in Iran, the message from the Iranian Free Trade Union. 48 days have passed since the suppression and arrest of workers gathering on May Day. Our country has witnessed amazing changes in our social movement. Despite the embezzlement and theft and incompetence and mismanagement, we continue to resist. We demand immediate increase in the minimum wage to over 1 million tomans a month, an end to temporary contracts, new forms of work contracts, disbanding of the Islamic Labor Councils as government organizations, and the setting up of shores and workers' organizations independent of the government. We demand immediate payment of workers' unpaid wages without any excuses. We demand an end to laying off workers and payment of inadequate unemployment insurance. The immediate release of all political prisoners, notably workers arrested on May Day, Jafar Azimzadeh, Golan Reza Khani, Saeed Yusi, Saeed Rostami, Mehdi Farahi Shandiz, Kaveh Mozaffari, Mansour Unsalu, Ibrahim Madadi, all of our leaders, an end to surveillance and harassment of workers and labor leaders. We demand the right to strike, the right to organize, the right to form trade unions, the right to protest, the right to assemble. We demand freedom of speech and the press as an absolute right. and we call for an end to sexual discrimination and the child labor that that dominates our society. Workers, we have a duty to intervene, to pose our demands independently, to rely on our own united strength, to work towards achieving human rights in Iran. These are the declarations of the trade unions and the workers under siege across Iran.
Yes. So you will be speaking, I have the information here, finally. You'll be speaking here in Santa Cruz. I'm speaking tonight with Ralph Schoenman, and he will be speaking at the Vets Hall in Santa Cruz. That's on Front Street next to the post office, the main post office. September 24th, the Vets Hall in Santa Cruz. The time, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure it's 7 o'clock.
By the way, Lewis, let me mention that it's not. I'm not speaking alone. Maya Schoen, my companion of 30 years, is going to be speaking, and Maya is the co-producer of Taking Aim.
Yeah, tell us.
Who has done a great deal of writing about Iran, and will be speaking to many of the issues that I've been discussing tonight.
Okay, so you are you and your wife are the producers and hosts of, what is the name of the program?
The program is called Taking Aim. Mm-hmm. It appears, in the U.S., in New York, it appears on Tuesdays, 5 o'clock New York time, and it's 2 o'clock Pacific time. And it appears 11 a.m. and 11 p.m. On the Progressive Radio Network, which is heard nationally. And anybody who goes to our archive, which is www.takingaimradio.com, can take down any of our programs of the last 8 years by subject, no charge, gratis.
Okay, well, we're looking forward to that event. I only have a few minutes left, but mm-hmm. one of the things that intrigued me about your biography was that you worked with Malcolm X in the 1960s mm-hmm. With respect to the battle for the Congo, is what it says. Would you talk about that for a couple of minutes, please?
Yes, I met Malcolm in 1964 when he was in London. And we had discussions at the time concerning the struggle for Congo. If you recall, at the time, Mobutu was the installed figure after the CIA murder of Lumumba, and the Congo was being fragmented. And at that time, there was a very distinguished figure in Nairobi, who had been, he was a man of Goan descent, who had been a leader of the Kenya Africa Union and has had a profound influence on many of the national and revolutionary figures in East Africa, Oscar Kambona, Julius Nyerere, Oginga Odinga, and many others. And he was publishing something called Pan-Africa. And I had discussions with Malcolm about this, and Malcolm met Pio Gama da Pinto in Nairobi, and they had serious discussions about internationalizing the struggle and coordinating it with efforts in the U.S. Close friend of mine, Kojo Amo Gottfried, who was a leader in Ghana of the youth movement and the ideological institute at Winneba during the time of Kwame Nkrumah. We were driving with Malcolm at that time, shortly before his return to the U.S., and we were pleading with him to wear a bulletproof vest, Malcolm having been poisoned in Cairo and before that in Accra. And what Malcolm said was, you know, bulletproof vests won't do. What we need is to build a mass movement across national frontiers so they cannot amputate our leadership with impunity. So each time they do that, it deepens the radicalization and spreads the movement instead of emasculating it. And, of course, in every political sense, he was correct. But he was murdered a short time thereafter in New York. And I shall mention something of of, I think, importance about that execution. P.O. Had a habit. He was a lawyer. And when he would go to work each morning in Nairobi, his little girl, his daughter, would get into the car with him, and he would drive down to the end of the driveway and stop, and his little girl would get out, and then he'd continue on to work. And on this particular morning, this little girl got out, and P.O. was caught in a crossfire and executed, murdered. That occurred right about the time that Malcolm was being gunned down at the Audubon in New York. And there are not many who missed the symmetry of that who were involved in the struggle.
Well, thank you for telling that story. So I'm going to – I'm out of time.
Okay,
and,
Lewis.
But I want to thank you very much for doing this interview.
Lewis, could you hold one quick second, please?
Certainly. And we've been speaking tonight with Ralph Schoenman. He will be speaking here in Santa Cruz on September 24th at the Vets Hall in Santa Cruz, along with his wife, Maya Schoen. And together they are the...
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Lewis, hello, Lewis.
Go ahead. Yeah, I'm here.
I'm sorry.
That's no problem. So I'm just reminding my listeners about your speaking date. Any final thoughts?
Well, I know that many people have legitimate and correct anxiety about the targeting of Iran and the attempt to demonize the Ahmadinejad regime as a vehicle for orchestrating an attack on Iran, and certainly attempts to further strangle the economy of Iran. And let me make very clear that that ambition remains very real, and imperialism tries to exploit every facet of weakness of the regime. But the brutality of this regime and its isolation from its own population is a function of its character, of its class character. And we don't give any quarter to imperialism or its designs or that of Zionism upon the Iranian people or Iranian self-determination, and we defend the Iranian government against all imperial attack, no matter who its government is of the moment. We defended Haile Selassie in Ethiopia against the attacks of Mussolini. We defend Saddam Hussein against the attacks of American imperialism. But that does not mean that we abandon our obligations to analyze the class character of such regimes and to take as our starting point the needs, the interests of the class, the working class of those countries, of every country, because that's our point of departure. What motivates us is the defense of the needs of the mass of the population, and a repressive regime has to be exposed as such, even as we oppose imperialism.
All right. Thank you. And thank you again for speaking with us tonight.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right. Good night. Right. And that was Ralph Schoenman, longtime peace activist, and I would have, I guess he would describe himself as an activist defending the people from imperialism. So you can hear him again September 24th. He will be at the Vets Hall here in Santa Cruz at 7 p.m. And check your... You know, I guess probably check the indie media calendar for that, and hopefully it'll be posted there. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and my name is Louis LaFortune. I am the host of this program, which is the Resistance and Renewal Radio program. Thank you to Maureen Smith for organizing, for arranging that interview, and Maureen is also the person who has... Maureen and her husband, Mike Smith, have put together this event with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen at the Vets Hall on September 24th. So hope to see you there. Hope you enjoyed the interview. And that's going to do it for me tonight. This is Resistance and Renewal Radio. I'm looking for my outro music. I'm sure it's here somewhere. Oh, there it is. So stay tuned for the our duck show. Studio has been invaded by the host of the Our Duck Show. It's a benign invasion. It's nothing to be worried about. And so Our Duck Show coming up here. I'm going to run just about 3 or 4 minutes late because I am. Anyway, here's no excuses, no explanation. Here's the here's Phil Oakes. I ain't marching anymore. See you next time. Thanks for everything. Bye.
I'll do you for you now, you nice people here. A protest song. A protest song is defined as something, a song you don't hear on the radio. And they'll say you don't hear it on the radio because the guy can't sing it, because the words are no good, or because they play the shit that they play these days. But it's all got to do with the process all around the Western Trail, and that includes England and France and Canada and America. They have the media syndrome where they control everybody's mind by the use of fairly mindless and mind-distorting distortions of the facts, which led all of us into the Vietnamese War and led all of us into the Kennedy assassinations. So, what can you do? I mean, here you are, a helpless soul, a helpless piece of flesh, amid all this cruel, cruel machinery and terrible, heartless men. So, all you can do is turn away from the filth and hopefully start to build something new someday. And it affects all of us. It affects the people here, too. So, here's a turning away song.